to get a boyfriend.
Shh, Rebecca says. Don't let her hear you.
Luca drops his voice, leans closer.
But how?
Like, she was walking home one day by herself, and this boy noticed her, and he called to her. That was always happening to her wherever she went in the city. So she just did what she always did, which was to ignore him. But he didn't like that. So he chased after her and grabbed her by the throat and a few other parts, and he told her that he was her boyfriend now. Luca feels his face wash into a shade of gray.
I shouldn't be telling you all this stuff, Rebecca says. I'm sorry.
No, I can handle it, Luca says. You don't have to be sorry. Rebecca picks at a loose orange thread on the seam of her jeans.
I haven't been able to talk to anybody about this since it happened, she says.
Only Soledad, and she won't speak of it. Luca nods.
I understand.
But it's like you're my friend, you know? Rebecca smiles.
I am, Luca says, and he feels proud.
You seem a lot older than you are. Like you're this old man in this tiny body.
Luca tries to take this as a compliment. His body isn't tiny. It's only moderately smaller than a typical 8-year-old's.
I've seen bad things, too, he assures her.
Yeah? He nods. I guess you wouldn't be on top of this train if you hadn't.
Es un prerequisito, Luca says. A prerequisite.
Rebecca nods.
My papi died, he whispers.
He hasn't wanted to say those words out loud, to admit it. This is the first time, and he can feel the words leaving his chest, like something rotten has broken off inside him and fallen away. There is a ragged wound now, where he'd been holding those words.
Oh no, Rebecca says.
She leans forward like she's suddenly off balance, but then she touches her forehead against his, and they both close their eyes. The rest of the sister's story emerges in stolen moments over the next several days. How Soledad's unwanted boyfriend turned out to be the palabrero of the local clica of an international gang. How he was, therefore, just violent and powerful enough to do whatever he liked to her without fear of reprisal. But not quite violent or powerful enough to preserve her all for himself. How Soledad's life quickly deteriorated into a series of lurid traumas. How Soledad confided some of it to Rebecca, but went to extravagant lengths to hide the situation from their papi, because she understood that were he to discover her circumstances, his resulting efforts to protect her would get him killed. Rebecca knows that Ivan, which was the name of the unwanted boyfriend, sometimes allowed Soledad to go to school, and sometimes did not. But there is much she doesn't know. How he always allowed Soledad to go home at nights, because the idea of her having a curfew served, in the depravity of his mind, to sustain her virtue. How her decency, her moral resistance to him, her very obvious loathing, all turned him on. How as Soledad began to perceive this, she sometimes pretended to enjoy his company in hopes he'd grow tired of her. And how now, when Soledad remembers that pretend enjoyment, she feels flooded with shame. It was futile, anyway, because that effort at subterfuge was no match for her beauty. One day, Ivan showed Soledad a picture of the hotel where her father worked. He said her father's name to her, and then gave her a cell phone and instructed her to answer it whenever it rang or beeped, no matter what she was doing. He showed her how to text. It's good to be alive, right, Sole? He said, and she cringed at the way he shortened her name, as if he were someone she loved. During all those weeks of suffering, Soledad, who knew the only flimsy protection she could offer her baby sister was her unaccustomed distance, barely saw Rebecca at all. When Ivan called, Soledad stopped whatever she was doing, as instructed, and she went to him. She left her shopping basket in the middle of the aisle, or got out of the line where she waited for the bus, or lifted herself out of the chair in the middle of her reading class, and she moved across the city to him like a zombie magnet. Twice, Soledad saw Ivan shoot people in the back of the head. Once, she watched him kick a 9-year-old boy in the stomach until he coughed up blood, because that was one of the ways they initiated new chequeos into the gang. That day, she asked him what would happen if she didn't answer her cell phone sometime, and he backhanded her in the mouth, leaving a bruise along her lower jaw and a welt on her lip that was difficult to explain to Papi. "I only meant if I was in the shower or something," she explained to Ivan afterward, "or if my papi was there and I couldn't answer." And when she said this, Ivan cocked back and pretended he was going to hit her again. And Soledad winced and cowered. And Ivan laughed and said, "Just answer your phone, puta." And after that, he let one of his homeboys pay him to be alone with her for an hour. Soledad didn't actively want to die, not really. She'd always been a happy child. She remembered how it had felt to be happy, and she wasn't sure she could ever feel that feeling again. But the memory of it provided her with some measure of hope. Still, during that long stretch of weeks with Ivan, there were plenty of times when it crossed her mind to drag a razor blade across the raised tangle of vessels in her wrist, or to lift the homemade gun from where Ivan placed it on his bedside table before he did what he did to her, to train it on him and pull the trigger, to shoot him and watch his brain splatter satisfyingly against the ceiling above him, and then to turn the gun on herself before his homies could swoop in and punish her. To be done with it all. To be free from this repetitive torture. But then she thought of her papi, the suffering her release would cause him, her mami and abuela back home in the cloud forest too, when Papi would have to go home to their mountain place and deliver the news. But more than any of that, even, Soledad thought of Rebecca. Her sister was afraid, but still intact. Rebecca was still undiscovered, and it was the improbable miracle of that truth that kept Soledad going, the possibility of her baby sister's salvation. Then one afternoon, Ivan lay in bed wearing boxer shorts and smoking a cigarette. He blew the smoke towards Soledad, where she sat slightly curled over herself on the edge of the bed near his feet. "So I heard you got a sister," he said, nudging her backside with his toe. Soledad was very grateful not to be facing him when he said this, because she knew her face would have told the whole story of panic that these words provoked. "How come you never mentioned her?" Soledad was wrapped in a sheet. It was tucked beneath her arms. She made her face into the approximation of a smile and turned it toward him. "We're not close," she said. "She's nothing like me." Outside, she could hear two of Ivan's homeboys arguing, but there were also children playing somewhere beyond, squealing, chasing one another up the block. The sunlight rocketed through the open window. "Nothing like you, huh?" he said, sitting up and yanking the sheet down to her waist. He tapped the bottom of her breast and watched it react. "That's not what I heard." Then he tossed his still full cigarette into the ashtray beside the bed and sat up on his knees. "Damn, girl, let me get in there again." Soledad endured him with something more immediate and terrifying than her regular revulsion. And when he was finished, and he instructed her to come back in the morning and bring her sister, she went home, packed her backpack, took all the little bits of money Papi had managed to save from the coffee can on top of the refrigerator, and then sat down at the table to wait for Rebecca to get home. She wrote Papi a note. "Querido Papi, I love you so, so much, Papi, and I'm sorry for these words I have to write that I know will break your heart. And I'm sorry for taking all your savings, but I know that you work hard and save this money only for us, and I know that you'd insist we take it and use it to get away from here if you knew the terrible things that were happening to me. And I didn't tell you sooner because I thought I could protect you and Rebecca if I stayed quiet and just did what they told me to do. But there are monsters in this city, Papi. And now I'm so scared, and I have to get Rebecca out of here before they hurt her too. So we're leaving today, Papi. We are already gone. And you must be very careful and look after yourself, please. We are taking you with us in our hearts, and we will call you when we get to El Norte, Papi. And we'll send for you when we have jobs, and you can come to us, and you can bring Mami and Abuela too. And we will all be together again as it is meant to be. God bless you, Papi, until we meet again. All my love from your devoted daughter, full of sorrow, Soledad. Much of this Rebecca doesn't know, but she does know that Soledad texted their cousin Cesar in Maryland that afternoon while she waited for Rebecca to get home. And she knows that Cesar didn't ask any questions because he already knew all the worst possible answers, and all he wanted to do was get them out of there. Rebecca knows that Cesar asked if they could wait a few days so he could try to arrange for a coyote to bring them all the way from Honduras to El Norte. But Soledad told him they couldn't wait. They were leaving today, right now. Rebecca knows that Cesar has since prepaid for their crossing with a trustworthy coyote who will meet them at the border. Rebecca doesn't know that the sum of money their cousin paid for their crossing was $4,000 each. But even if she had known, that kind of money doesn't even make sense to her. It's so far into the realm of incomprehensible that it might as well have been $4 million. As Rebecca reveals what scraps of story she does have to Luca, he starts to understand that this is the one thing all migrants have in common. This is the solidarity that exists among them. Though they all come from different places and different circumstances, some urban, some rural, some middle class, some poor, some well-educated, some illiterate, Salvadoran, Honduran, Guatemalan, Mexican, Indian, each of them carries some story of suffering on top of that train and into El Norte beyond. Some, like Rebecca, share their stories carefully, selectively, finding a faithful ear and then chanting their words like prayers. Other migrants are like blown open grenades, telling their anguish compulsively to everyone they meet, dispensing their pain like shrapnel, so they might one day wake to find their burdens have grown lighter. Luca wonders what it would feel like to blow up like that. But for now, he remains undetonated, his horrors sealed tightly inside, his pin fixed snugly in place. Chapter 17. For both Lydia and the sisters, there's a constant tug of war between the gruesome feeling that something's chasing them, that they must move quickly away, and a physical hesitation, a reluctance to move blindly toward whatever unknown demons may loom in the road ahead. The Casa del Migrante they find in Celaya is a respite from that tug of war, and as such, after a sleepless night outdoors for Lydia, a holy blessing without compare. It's only midday when they arrive. Luca and Rebecca play basketball in the yard, and no one else can join. Some complicated game with jumbled rules of their own devising. Lydia and Soledad sit quietly together, watching from a nearby bench. They help in the kitchen, listening to Las Noticias on television, and then Lydia naps. When she wakens, she watches her son playing dominoes with Rebecca. She notes how quickly those two have bridged the gap between their respective ages, 8 and 14. Luca seems to have grown up, and Rebecca to have simplified quite neatly. So they meet seamlessly in the middle. It feels as though they've known each other forever, as though these girls have always been here, waiting to become a part of their lives. That night, Luca asks if he can snuggle in beneath Rebecca's arm in her bunk. It's not appropriate, Lydia draws the line. Luca knew it was a long shot anyway, but hardly any of the rules from his old life seemed to apply anymore, so he figured it was worth asking. He climbs in bed without complaint. Lydia hauls her backpack beneath the sheets by her feet and wraps its strap twice around her ankle. They all sleep soundly. Glory, glory to have a door with a lock. Soledad has told Lydia nothing of where she and her sister came from or what they endured. Lydia said nothing of her family circumstances either. But there's that silent bond of knowing between them regardless, a magic that's marginally maternal, but entirely female. So it's not surprising that in the morning, the girl, who seems much older than just the 18 months that separate her from her sister, and who's not typically so forthcoming about private matters regarding her body, confides to Lydia that she's pregnant. Taking her cue from Soledad, Lydia endeavors to deliver her response to this news in a calm, unvarnished manner. "Your baby will be a U.S. citizen," she whispers across the top of her coffee cup. Soledad shakes her head and stands up from the table to clear her plate. "The baby isn't mine," she says. When she stretches her arms above her and her baggy t-shirt graces the waist of her jeans, her tummy is still flat. That day and night at La Casa are so significant in their restorative value that in the weeks to come, when they think back to the halcyon memory of this place, their stay here will seem much longer than it was. Like all priests in Mexico, the padre who runs La Casa wears regular street clothes, a yellow polo shirt and a softened pair of blue jeans with a tar stain on one leg. His only religious adornment is a simple wooden cross that hangs from a leather cord around his neck. He's slender, with gray hair and glasses. There are more than 20 migrants resuming their journey today, and the padre gathers them in the yard before they leave. He gives a speech that Lydia thinks of as a kind of pep talk with an identity crisis, because he means to encourage them, but there's no pep in his talk. He stands on an upturned milk crate in front of the gathered crowd, and mostly, he warns them. "If it's possible for you to turn back, do so now. If you can go home again and make a life for yourself where you came from, if you can return there safely, I implore you, please do so now. If there is any other place for you to go, to stay away from these trains, to stay away from El Norte, go there now." Luca has his arm around Rebecca's waist, his head leaning in, her arm around his shoulder. Lydia looks at their faces. They do not flinch from these hard words. Some of the other migrants shift their weight nervously beneath them. "If it's only a better life you seek, seek it elsewhere," the padre continues. "This path is only for people who have no choice, no other option, only violence and misery behind you. And your journey will grow even more treacherous from here. Everything is working against you to thwart you. Some of you will fall from the trains. Many will be maimed or injured. Many will die. Many, many of you will be kidnapped, tortured, trafficked, or ransomed. Some will be lucky enough to survive all of that and make it as far as Estados Unidos, only to experience the privilege of dying alone in the desert beneath the sun, abandoned by a corrupt coyote or shot by a narco who doesn't like the look of you. Every single one of you will be robbed. Everyone. If you make it to El Norte, you will arrive penniless. That's a guarantee. Look around you. Go ahead. Look at each other. Only one out of three will make it to your destination alive. Will it be you?" He points at a man in his 50s with a neatly trimmed beard and a fresh t-shirt. "Sí, señor," the man answers. "Will it be you?" He points to a woman about Lydia's age with a silent toddler on her hip.
Sí, señor,
she says. Will it be you? He points at Luca. Lydia feels a crush of wild despair steal over her, but Luca lifts his small fist in the air and shouts his response.
Sí, seré yo.
The speech does the job of energizing the migrants and stealing their resolve, which in turn makes them restless and impatient during the long wait for the train. In the third hour, a few give up waiting and begin to walk. In the fourth and fifth hours, more follow. Luca, Lydia, and the girls head toward the western edge of the city in search of an overpass, but the only one they find is way too high. Jumping from there would be suicide. So they search instead for a curve where the train might slow down. It's mid-afternoon by the time La Bestia finally arrives, and it's more crowded than they've seen it before. Even from a distance, Lydia can see the silhouette of migrants atop the cars. It's moving much faster than when they boarded yesterday at San Miguel de Allende. Lydia nearly says they should wait. They're not going to make it. She wants to articulate her hesitation, but she's not quick enough, and now the train is too loud. The noise thunders into her bones. They all run, and she holds Luca's hand tightly in her fist. The men atop the train shout down to them instructions and encouragement. Rebecca goes up first, and then Soledad, who reaches back for Luca. He grabs at her with his free hand, and there's a terrifying moment where he's stretched between them, one arm taut with Soledad on the shrieking beast, and the other linked to Lydia, racing beneath. He's like a taffy, soft and exposed. And then Lydia hurls his little arm toward the train, and he's up. Soledad has him, and then the men from above, lifting. He is safe. He is safe. Lydia runs, not yet relieved, not until she joins him there. She runs, and the train is picking up speed, and she's falling behind the ladder, and she can't keep up. And then a burst of panic makes her legs go like pistons, and she grabs at the metal bars, terrified, terrified that her legs won't be able to maintain this speed, that they'll drop, that she'll go under. But this is not her day, because all at once her feet have found the bottom rung, and her hands are only one rung above them, and the train is picking up speed so quickly now she can't believe the velocity. But her body, all four of her limbs are attached to the train now, and she's curled there at the bottom of the ladder like a bug, and she allows herself one tiny sob of relief before she uncurls herself and, pushing up from the bottom rung, begins to climb. When she gets to the top, she reaches for Luca, and she straps him down quickly with the belts, and then she holds him and cries quietly into his hair until her heart begins to calm. Lydia wants to keep Luca and the sisters to herself, to set their little group apart from the others as a unit. But the men are so friendly, so eager to help. Too eager, she worries. There aren't many women on La Bestia, and very few children. So Lydia feels noticed by every single man they see. She's aware that she and her companions represent something to these men. They look like home, or they look like salvation, or they look like prey. To an halcón, they might look like reward money. And even if none of that were true, the two sisters cause a stir wherever they go, just by the very presence of their faces. Lydia is distracted by these observations, which is why, despite her constant watchfulness, she doesn't immediately notice the boy near the other end of their train car watching her. But Luca does, and he remembers. And in the act of remembering, he experiences a strange, incongruous moment of satisfaction, a brief wash of endorphins he's never noticed before, but that his brain has been performing all his life. A slight chemical self-congratulatory pleasure for achieving this task of almost perfect recall. Luca has seen that face before. He recognizes that boy. And so even before the tattoo is visible from where the boy is sitting, cross-legged at the other end of the train car, Luca recollects it. the bloody sickle creeping out of the sock. The three drops of bloodied ink dripping from the blade. Luca shivers beneath the hot sun. The boy is staring at Mommy. And then, as Luca watches him, he retrieves a phone from his pocket, scrolls around a little bit, and then looks back at Mommy again. Then he puts it in his pocket. Luca is paralyzed by fear. A moment passes before he can give wind to his voice. Mommy, he says simply, and he thinks he says it quite calmly, though his body, still strapped to the top of that train, feels like a wild flap of panic. Mommy leans in, but not close enough. He flutters his hand so she understands.
Come here. Get closer. Do it quickly.
Lydia scoots closer to him.
Mommy, I recognize someone.
These words alone are enough to send a slice of cold down Lydia's spine.
Okay,
she says, willing her brain to slow down.
Okay. Who is it?
Her arms and legs feel like they've turned to liquid, but the fingers of one hand stay tightly curled around the grating. The other hand goes automatically to the chain at her neck. She slips her index finger inside Sebastian's wedding ring.
Don't look, Luca says. He's staring at you, at us.
Lydia's mantra comes heroically crashing through her consciousness, penetrating the violent static of this new information. Don't think, don't think, don't think, her brain tells her.
Okay,
she repeats.
Who?
Luca leans so his lips graze the top of her ear.
The boy from the first Casa del Migrante at Huehuetoca.
Lydia breathes deeply.
Okay.
Some boy they cross paths with along the way. She feels relief in the jelly-like roll of her shoulders.
Oh, Luca,
she says, and she wants to reprimand him for scaring her to death. But how is he supposed to know what may or may not provoke a stampede of dread in the confusing wasteland of their new life? So she also wants to laugh, to kiss him, to tell him not to worry so much. She puts her arm around him.
It's fine,
she says. It's okay.
Don't you remember that really bad kid? That cholo who got kicked out of the casa for bothering that girl? He did something bad to her.
Yes, she remembers. Oh, shit. The women at breakfast claimed he was a sicario. Only moments ago, Lydia had dared to feel comforted by their unlikely progress. She'd allowed herself to indulge in the new fear of anonymous, indiscriminate threats. Now, here is some sicario from God knows what cartel, staring her down from 100 yards away. She looks at the other migrants seated around them. Any one of them could be a narco. Any one of them could be a jardinero. She folds herself over her legs so her face is nearly touching the grating in front of her. Or rather, her body does this without her mind instructing it to. An instinct to hide herself, to melt into the scenery, to disappear. Luca leans down too.
There's something else, he says,
because he knows, although he doesn't understand how he knows it or what it means, that there's something deeply unsettling about the tattoo.
What is it?
Lydia is ready for this information, whatever it is. She opens the door to it.
A tattoo. He has a tattoo.
Her machete is strapped to her shin beneath her pant leg. She can feel the cinch of the holster, the weight it presses into her skin. She whispers to Luca.
What sort of tattoo?
Like a big curved knife, mommy, he says, with three drops of blood. Lydia's mouth goes dry, her fingers cold. Her body trembles from the inside out. Core to tip, beginning in her lungs. But to Luca, her face looks calm and impassive.
Like a sickle?
She needs, but does not want, clarity.
Like this?
She traces the shape of it on the palm of his hand with her finger. Luca nods.
Thank you for telling me, mijo, she says. You did the right thing. Good boy.
She touches his ear.
Before Lydia can formulate a plan, before she can absorb this information, indeed, before she can even turn her face in the direction Luca has indicated to glimpse the boy with a jardinero tattoo, there's a collective shriek and terrible commotion two cars up. They turn instinctively in the direction of the clamor. Everyone holds their breath, and then almost immediately, with a long hoot of its whistle, the train enters a tunnel, and all is in darkness.
Mommy, Luca screams. I'm here,
Lydia gropes for his hand. I'm here, mijo.
What happened?
I don't know, mijo.
I'm scared.
I know, mijo. It's okay. She reaches through the blackness and touches the soft fuzz at the back of his head. The tunnel is a short one, and soon they blast out into daylight again. And the sisters, who'd been dozing in a small heap until the commotion, sit up and blink rapidly at each other. A weary Morse code.
What happened? Soledad asks.
There's still a lot of yelling coming from the car two ahead of theirs, and a couple of voices begin to emerge from the fray, louder than the others. One man is wailing,
Hermano, hermano, hermano!
And then he stands up on top of the train, and his companions grab him and pull him back down. And then a moment later, the scene repeats itself. He seems determined to jump off. And now the story is traveling back along the train until it gets to the cluster of men seated in front of the sisters. One young man turns to share it. His brother fell off. Soledad gasps and crosses herself.
Dios mío, how?
She asks. The man points back at the tunnel they just passed through. Didn't see the tunnel. Was sitting up too tall on his knees and bang. He hit his head on the top of the tunnel and got knocked right off. Soledad's face is a twist of horrified compassion. She leans past the young man because she can see now, beyond him, that the wailing brother is back on his feet a third time. The words fly out of her mouth by instinct. Her hand darts toward him.
Stop him, she screams. Grab him!
But it's too late. The man has jumped. He's a distorted silhouette of arched arms and legs against the bleary yellow of the late morning sky. His shadow makes the shape of grief as he hurtles toward the earth.
Too far. It's too far.
Soledad's voice is still working independently of her body.
Oh my God, oh my God!
Their train car is already passing where the jumper has landed. His body rolls down the steep embankment and away. Luca counts his arms and legs. 1, 2, 3, 4. He counts them again to make sure. He still has all four, but they don't seem to be working. His body comes to a stop in a thicket of weeds, and the train storms on without him, without his brother. Soledad is almost catatonic after watching the man jump, as if the incident loosened the fragile scab of her own suffering. She lies down again, and Rebecca pulls her sister's head into her lap. She strokes Soledad's long black hair back away from her forehead and quietly sings a song in a language Lydia has never heard before. Soledad stays there unblinking, but soon her expression softens. Her dark eyebrows turn slack and her lids flutter closed. She drifts into some state akin to sleep. Lydia doesn't stare at the boy at the other end of the freight car, but she's hyper-aware now of his attention. He sits with his legs outstretched and his weight leaned back on his propped hands, and he's watching them. Lydia does recognize him now, but only because Luca mentioned it. He's wearing oversized red shorts and a huge white t-shirt. Over that, the giant red and black tank top jersey of some professional basketball team, and big diamond earrings in both ears. The jewelry is probably fake, but it does the trick of making him look like a hip-hop star,
which is exactly the look he was hoping to achieve when he shaved those two tiny pinstripes into his right eyebrow. Lydia doesn't turn her head. With the precision of a huntress, she can sense his movements with her peripheral vision. When he lifts his flat-brimmed black baseball cap to scratch beneath it, when he leans slightly over the edge of the train car to spit, when he unscrews the cap from his water bottle to take a drink. She wonders if he can feel her anxiety, if her studied nonchalance is biologically ineffective, if her body is shooting off alarm pheromones he can detect. A primal consciousness has sprung up between them. So she's aware, too, of the ways her own body responds when, on a long stretch of straight, open track, he lifts himself up from his position and moves toward them. Lydia's heartbeat increases, her pupils dilate, her grip on Luca tightens. Indeed, all her muscles either constrict or twitch, and her skin prickles with goosebumps. Her palms grow slick and clammy. She lets go of Luca and gropes at the machete strapped to her lower leg beneath her pants. Everyone watches the young man pick his way gingerly past the groups of migrants on the train top. Everyone always watches when someone is on the move. They look for signs of drunkenness or erratic behavior. They look for the gleam of a concealed blade. They're especially alert to this young man because it's so obvious what he is. They lean away from him as he passes. "You're looking for the cafe car, amigo?" an older man in a straw hat asks him. The nearby migrants laugh, but it's a suspicious laughter. Why is he alone? Where does he think he's going? "Just stretching my legs," the young man answers. They keep an eye on his tattoo after he passes, their friendliness a tiny facade. Most migrants understand the significance of those three drops of tattooed blood, one for each kill. Lydia pulls the machete from its small holster and draws it out from beneath her pant leg as the boy approaches. She presses the button to engage the blade and feels gratified by its appearance. Luca watches her silently as she conceals it beneath her sleeve. Some small flash of instinct advises Lydia to ditch the blade and watch instead for a passing bush, for some soft landing point, and then to pitch her son from the train as soon as she spots a place where he might survive the fall. She reaches over and briefly grabs his leg to make sure her body doesn't wildly obey that foolish impulse. She presses gravity onto his folded legs and feels grateful for the insurance of the canvas belt. The boy's shadow is upon them. Lydia doesn't look up. "Yo, I think I know you," he says. He puts his body down in the very small space between Lydia and the sisters. He squeezes in there, and if her body could tense up any further, it would. She can feel Rebecca trying to catch her eye, but she doesn't look at the girl because she doesn't want to draw her into whatever this is. Rebecca reshuffles her body, making room for the newcomer. And meanwhile, Lydia's brain has been so busy telling her to run that it failed to come up with a suitable plan for this moment. So she says the first words that show up in her mouth. "I didn't think so, but my son recognized you from back the road away, outside Mexico City." She does not say, "Huehuetoca," in case the memory of his eviction from the place provokes his anger. She holds her body like a cocked gun. "Así?" He leans over to smile at Luca, which confuses Lydia. She can't understand the chit-chat. If he's a sicario, then why is he plopped down here shooting the breeze? And where is his weapon inside all that abundant clothing? "What up, Wei?" he says to Luca. "Cool hat." He stretches to touch the brim of Papi's red baseball cap, but Luca moves out of his reach. "Anyway, I'm Lorenzo," he says, putting his hand out to Lydia. She's never been more reluctant to shake someone's hand, but she shakes it lightly and retracts herself quickly, replacing her grip on the machete beneath her sleeve. "And you are?" "He can't be any older than 18, 20, Lydia thinks. How is it that he speaks like this, as if she owes him her name?
Araceli.
She expels the fake name on her breath like a surfer riding a dying tide. Lorenzo shakes his head.
I don't think so.
Lydia bites the inside of her mouth. If she ever doubted herself capable of stabbing another human being, that uncertainty is no more.
Pardon me? You're not Araceli.
The only response she can manage is a soft snorting noise. Luca leans against her. When Lorenzo reaches into his pocket, she coils her body so tightly she begins to shake. She will thrust the blade into his neck, but no, she's in a bad position. There's no leverage. Would she be able to kill him? Or would she only injure him, incite him to repay her failed violence? It would be better to jump, to curl around Luca like a shell, so at least he would survive this moment, the leap from the speeding train. But could Luca survive whatever follows that, once she's gone? Lydia will only get one opportunity to sacrifice herself. Then Luca's on his own forever. Her body twitches with indecision. She turns the handle of the concealed machete, cold against her palm. But then Lorenzo's hand emerges from his pocket with only a cell phone. No pistol, no blade. He clicks the thing to life and scrolls through the pictures. Lydia's breath shudders through her.
That's you, right?
He turns the phone so she can see. It's a selfie Javier took of the two of them together at the bookstore. They're on opposite sides of the counter, both leaning across, their foreheads touching at the temple. Lydia looks directly at the camera, but Javier's face is turned slightly in, his eyes pulled toward her. Lydia remembers the day he took it, how he told her that Marta had instructed him thoroughly in the art of the selfie, how hard they had laughed together.
Lydia Quijano Perez, right?
The boy beside her says. She tucks her lips inside her mouth and twists her neck once, but there's nothing even marginally convincing in the gesture. Lorenzo holds the phone up beside her face to check her features against the likeness.
Yep, yep. Good-looking folks, he says.
And then, in a voice that sounds uncannily sincere, I'm sorry about your family. What passes for silence on the train is the slow-motion roar of the engine hauling countless tons of chugging, clacking steel along the track behind it. The wheels shriek in their tracks, metal whines against the metal. The couplers between the cars knuckle and grind and squeal. Several beats of that kind of silence pass before Lydia finds her voice.
What do you want?
Lorenzo powers the phone off and puts it back in his pocket.
What do I want? Shoot, he whistles. Same things as anybody, I guess. Nice house, a little bling, a good-looking girl.
He turns and smiles at Rebecca, who's still sitting quite close to them, but doesn't seem to be listening. She doesn't meet his gaze, and Lydia doubts she can hear their conversation over the noise of the train. On her lap, Soledad's eyes are still closed. Lorenzo examines his nails, looking for one to bite, while Lydia watches.
What do you want from me? She clarifies.
He finds a tiny, unassaulted white corner of fingernail and rips it off with his teeth. He spits it over the edge.
Nothing, he shrugs. Just being neighborly.
Where did you get that picture? Lydia scrunches up her nose and uses her chin to point in the direction of the phone in his pocket.
Mami, I hate to tell you, he says. Everybody in Guerrero got that picture.
Lydia sucks in a breath. It's not exactly news, but it does validate her fear.
For what purpose?
She wants absolute clarity. Lorenzo smirks at her sideways.
You for real?
I need to know what we're up against. Lorenzo pauses, then shrugs, Word was to bring you in. This is a surprise. Maybe only Hollywood gangsters say things like dead or alive, but that was what she'd expected. She tries to push this information into her internal hard drive, but it doesn't compute. Not to kill me? She asks. To kill us? Lorenzo sighs. This isn't how this conversation was supposed to go. She's not supposed to be the one asking the questions. Wait, I said too much already. I'm not trying to get myself killed too. Lydia shifts uncomfortably beside him, the handle of the machete growing sweaty in her hand. So that's why you're here? To bring us in? Maybe Javier wants only to kill them himself, to witness her suffering. She and Luca will not go with this boy. She will kill him if she has to. She'll do it in front of Luca if she must. Nah, Lorenzo says. I left all that behind me in Guerrero. He waves his arm toward the south. Lydia does not loosen her grip on the machete. Okay? De verdad, new leaf, he grins. I'm out. She feels unqualified to assess this claim. She makes no response. How'd you get out of Acapulco, though? Lorenzo asks after a moment. Everybody was looking for you. You got magic powers or something. You some kind of santera? Una bruja? Lydia surprises herself with a laugh, but it's only a husk of a sound. I suppose fear has certain magical properties. She'll never know how narrow their escape really was. That two of Javier's men opened the door to their room at the Hotel Duquesa Imperial just as she and Luca were entering the lobby of the hotel next door. So where are you headed now? Lorenzo asks. I don't know, she lies. We haven't really decided. Lorenzo pulls his knees up so his baggy shorts sag beneath. He gathers his arms around his legs. I'm going to L.A., he says. I got a cousin out there in Hollywood doing his thing. As good a place as any, she says. And then the train silence returns, and in that thundering quiet, she wonders, why, if he was well-connected in Los Jardineros, if he was making enough money to afford those expensive sneakers and that decent cell phone, if he was okay with earning that first drop of tattooed blood and the second and the third, then what made him leave Guerrero? There are infinite possible answers, she knows. Perhaps he disliked murdering. Perhaps he felt that the acts of violence he committed had some undesirable effect on him. Perhaps he had nightmares, the faces of the people he'd killed floating up before him whenever he closed his eyes. Maybe he was haunted, hunted, ragged in his soul. Or maybe the precise opposite was true. Perhaps he was so entirely without conscience that he'd been unable, even, to adhere to whatever deformed excuse for a moral code Los Jardineros exercised. Maybe he raped the wrong woman, or stole money from one of his jefes. Or maybe he murdered so gleefully that his depravity turned him into a liability. Maybe he's running, too. Or maybe none of these things are true. Perhaps he hasn't left Los Jardineros at all, and he really is here only for her. Whatever the case, Lydia feels shriveled by Lorenzo's presence. He's a menace, sitting beside her, and now the threat feels urgent again. It's all around her. She breathes it, and it's the same as ever, senseless, confusing, categorically terrifying. Javier feels as close as the day she first confronted him in the bookshop, the Russian nesting dolls. He'd reached for her hand. She can feel his fingers pressing into the veins at her wrist. She can hear the sicario urinating into the toilet on the other side of Abuela's green-tiled wall. Lydia wishes this boy would move away from them. 9 days and 426 miles from their escape, they haven't made any headway at all. Chapter 18. Luca likes the estates where all the homes are lined up like soldiers wearing identical uniforms. Indestructible white stucco walls, helmets of red Spanish tile, all tilted at the same angle to the sun. He likes the anonymity of them and thinks how nice it would be to live inside one of those houses with Mami, how nobody'd ever find them there. One thing he doesn't like is when the train tracks temporarily veer south, because even though he misses home, he misses only the life that existed in Acapulco before the quinceañera, and he understands that to be a place that no longer exists. It's nostalgia for a phantom limb. So he's relieved when the tracks bend toward the west again, and then, near a neat little town in Jalisco, sidle up beside El Rio Grande de Santiago, and at long last, curve northward. The city appears gradually, and with several false starts where Luca observes all the familiar symptoms of an urban metropolis, food vendors who pause at their grills to wave up at the passing migrants, the occasional clothesline strung with bright colors snapping in the sunny wind, a gathering of rowdy kids along the fence of a schoolyard. And then, boom, it all recedes. And it's just cornfields, cornfields, cornfields. Two times this happens. Three. Four. And then finally, unmistakably, Guadalajara. Second largest city in Mexico, state capital of Jalisco, population 1.5 million people. All across the top of the train, migrants prepare to disembark. They wake their friends, stuff wadded-up jacket pillows into their bags. They tighten the straps on one another's backpacks. Mami unstraps herself from the train but leaves Luca's belt attached to the grating. Lorenzo sits in the same spot, in the same position, and observes. Luca doesn't like the way he watches Rebecca and Soledad. Mami, Luca says as the train slows enough that some of the men on their car begin to climb down the ladders and jump to the gravel below. Lydia is rolling up her canvas belt, and she looks at Luca with her what face. I don't need the belt, he says. You need the belt. Mami. This time she does the more aggressive version of her what face. If I'm able to jump on and off a moving train, don't you think it's a little silly to buckle me in like a toddler? Luca juts out his chin at her. She grabs that chin in her hand, pulls her face down to his. The unchanged nature of her temper when he's ill-mannered is a comfort like a hot bath. It is not silly, she says. We ride these trains because we have no choice, but they are extremely dangerous, Luca. Did you learn nothing back there when that man fell? Okay, he says irritably. Fine. He tries to wriggle his chin away from her, but she only squeezes harder. He still has control of his own eyeballs, though. She can't squeeze those. He moves his gaze away from her face to her left ear. Don't interrupt me, she says, and look at me when I'm speaking to you. He looks at the earlobe. Luca, look at me. He returns his gaze to her face momentarily and then moves it away again. Listen, I know this is all crazy. It's reckless and wild, riding these trains, sleeping in strange places, eating strange things. And I know I haven't said it before now, but Luca, I'm so proud of you. He looks her briefly in the eye. I am, she says. It's incredible how strong you are, that you're able to do these inconceivable things. Luca has an unexpected thought. Can you imagine what Papi would say? Lydia lets go of his chin and smiles at him. Papi would say we are both crazy. Tears spring into Luca's eyes, but he doesn't want them there, so he makes them disappear. Lydia drops her voice to a whisper. Papi would be so proud of you. You're capable of things I had no idea you could do, Luca. She squeezes his knee. I never knew. She reaches across the landscape of their tangled legs to grab Luca's hand.
But you are still my boy. Do you understand?
He nods.
Y por Dios, if anything happened to you, Luca, I couldn't bear it. I know how much you've grown in these last days, but your body is still only 8 years old.
Almost nine, he says.
Almost nine, she agrees. But please, please listen. Never be complacent. Never assume you're safe on this train. No one is safe. Do you understand? No one.
She squeezes his hands.
Machismo will get you killed.
Luca nods again. The train has slowed to a placid roll beneath them, and Soledad and Rebecca both tie up their hair to disembark. They're wearing their backpacks, and they're turned, talking with a group of four men who've been in front of them since Celaya. One of the men has made this journey before. He's been deported twice from San Diego, so this is his third pass through Guadalajara. He's warning them. Lorenzo eavesdrops.
You have to get off before El Verde, the man tells the sisters. You have to walk the next part of the tracks.
Why?
Soledad reaches up to tighten her black hair into its fixed coil.
The people in this city are kind to migrants, God bless them. You will find a good welcome here. But first, you have to get past La Policía. They clear the trains at El Verde, and if they catch you...
The man finishes only with a shake of his head.
Don't let them catch you,
Soledad fills in the blank for him.
That's right, he says, and stay with a group. You can come with us if you want.
His friends, one by one, begin moving toward the ladder, and he follows. Rebecca relays all this information quickly to Lydia and suggests going with them. Lydia hesitates. She knows how dangerous it is to trust anyone on La Bestia. There are thugs and rapists and thieves and narcos hidden in the ranks of La Policía in every town. But it's not only the police who deserve their suspicion. It's every single person they meet. Shopkeepers, food vendors, humanitarians, children, priests, even their fellow migrants, especially their fellow migrants. She glances at Lorenzo's clean, expensive sneakers. It's a common tactic for bad actors to ride the trains posing as migrants, working to gain the trust of unsuspecting travelers so they can lure them into a secluded place where they can commit some violence against them. Lydia understands the increased probability of that violence being leveled against the sisters. Any gesture of kindness, any valuable nugget of shared information, any pitiful story of heartbreak may be only a well-disguised trap, a prequel to robbery or rape or kidnapping. Lydia's brain makes her do the work of considering all this before she decides, but there's no time. The train rolls on and the men are getting off. In fact, the whole train seems to be emptying. These four men seem kind. They have the steep accents of Central Americans. They're probably Central Americans, right? Lydia has to decide. Lorenzo's waiting for her to decide, too. Why is he waiting? His lingering presence makes the decision. She unbuckles Luca and stuffs his belt into her pack.
Let's go.
Lorenzo follows. For the first while, it's all warehouses to one side of the tracks, and all dirt and grass and open sky on the other. So Luca has the impression of walking just outside of something, like the warehouses are a kind of border, fencing something better beyond. They stick to the tracks, where dozens of migrants walk ahead of and behind them, in a sort of miniature caravan. The boy Lorenzo hangs close, not walking with them, exactly, but following only a few feet behind, matching his pace to theirs. Luca is worried about that boy, but he's distracted by the unmistakable smell of chocolate, which adds to the sense that nearby there's something much better.
Do you smell that? Luca asks Rebecca.
Chocolate?
He nods.
Nope. Don't smell it, she says. Luca laughs. Well, I sure do.
They trudge ahead, passing behind the Hershey's factory, without ever realizing it's there. Luca presses a fist against his stomach to discourage the groaning. They haven't eaten since breakfast at the casa in Celaya, and now it's late afternoon.
Hungry? Mommy asks.
He nods.
Me too.
When the warehouses give way to brick and cinder block homes, the migrants are cheered by the appearance of two pigtailed girls in school uniforms, one slightly larger than the other, one with dimples and one with a scab on her knee. Their mother sits at a wooden stall nearby with a cooler of drinks and a small grill. She's selling lemonade and hot ears of grilled corn. A fat baby sleeps in a stroller by her side. There's a large basket there, to which the girls return in swoops, retrieving armloads of little white paper bags. These they pass out to the migrants with their blessings.
Bienvenidos a Guadalajara, the girls say,
and may God bless you on your journey.
The one with the scabby knee presses a bag into Luca's hand and one into Rebecca's.
Thank you, Luca says.
The girl skips away, the hem of her blue plaid skirt brushing against her brown legs as she goes. Luca rips into the bag.
Mommy, it's chocolate. There are three Hershey's Kisses inside.
As the city grows dense around them, people come and go across the tracks, carrying lunch boxes or bags of groceries. Kids with brightly colored backpacks hold their mother's hands and clamor across the rails. Many of them look Luca and Mommy right in the eye and say, God bless you, and they smile. Luca would like to smile back, but he feels peculiar too. He is unaccustomed to pity. At El Verde, there's a bench outside a neat walled-in garden. The bench is painted orange, pink, and yellow, and a sign on the wall behind it reads, Migrantes pueden descansar aquí. Migrants can rest here. A large mustached man is sitting on the bench, and when he sees the migrants approaching, he stands, fixes a cowboy hat over his bald head, and retrieves a bat-sized machete from the ground beneath him. He walks toward the tracks with the machete still in its sheath and keeps it tipped back over one shoulder.
Amigos, hoy es su día de suerte,
he says loudly so they can all hear. Today is your lucky day.
I will walk with you.
The migrants in front of Luca and Mami cheer, but Rebecca and Soledad exchange worried glances. The man falls in step beside them.
You are right to be afraid, he tells them, but not of me.
Rebecca sticks her thumbs under the straps of her backpack and says nothing.
You have come a long way, yes? Honduras? Guatemala?
Honduras.
Rebecca is first to relent.
Your journey has been okay so far?
He asks.
Rebecca shrugs.
They walk for a few moments in silence, only the sound of their jeans swishing beneath them as they go. Luca holds Mami's hand, but he strains against it, pulling her arm nearly taut as he tries to hear what the man is saying to the sisters.
Well, I want you to have happy memories of Guadalajara.
He smiles and catches Luca looking at him. He's so large he could use that machete as a toothpick. Luca shies back to Mami's side.
My name is Danilo, and when you get to wherever you're going, when you find a job and a good house, and you meet a beautiful gringo boy, and you get married and have your children, one day when you're an old lady and you're tucking your nietos into bed, I want you to tell them that long, long ago, you met a nice man in Guadalajara named Danilo, and that he walked with you, and that he swung his machete around to make sure the knuckleheads didn't get any ideas.
Rebecca laughs now. She can't help herself.
See, I'm not so bad.
Soledad is still apprehensive.
Where are all these knuckleheads hiding out?
Oh, amiguita, Danilo frowns. I'm afraid you will meet many of them in short order.
Soledad raises her eyebrows, but doesn't respond.
It's like the good, the bad, and the ugly in the city, Danilo says.
And the beautiful, Lorenzo adds, gesturing toward the sisters.
Lydia cringes. Why is he still here?
Walking just behind them and listening in on every word.
She shudders at his remark, noting how the girls draw their bodies closer in instinctive response.
Danilo continues as if Lorenzo hasn't spoken at all.
It's a long walk from here into the migrant places, he says, and there are many dangers.
What kind of dangers? Lydia asks.
The usual kind, Danilo says. La policía, railroad employees, security guards, especially dangerous for you two.
He looks at the sisters briefly.
It's better to get off the tracks before you get to Las Juntas. Go into the streets and make your way to one of the shelters. There are signs for them, or shopkeepers will point the way.
If anyone says they will take you there, don't go with them. If anyone offers you a job or a place to stay, don't go with them. If anyone talks to you first, don't speak with them. If you need directions, ask only the shopkeepers.
I will go with you as far as La Piedrera, a few miles.
Why? Soledad asks.
Why what?
Why walk with us?
Why not? Danilo says.
I do this at least 3 times a week. I walk with the migrants. It's my hobby. Good exercise.
But if it's as dangerous as you say, why do you do it? What's in it for you?
Danilo has the kind of eyes that protrude slightly from beneath his lids, so there's no possibility of hiding their expression when he's in conversation.
Luca can see that he's not annoyed by Soledad's inquiry. He appreciates her skepticism.
I will tell you the truth, he says.
Then he pauses for a moment to smooth down his mustache with his thumb and index finger.
When I was a teenager, I stole a truck. My father died in a work accident, and I was angry with his employer, so I stole that man's truck. I destroyed all the windows and the headlights using my father's hammer. And then I slashed its tires, and I drove it into a sewer ditch.
Seems reasonable to me, Rebecca says.
I drank for 3 months, and I did terrible things in my grief. But I never got caught, and God provided me with a good life anyway, despite my sins. So this is my penance. I am like the guardian devil for migrants who pass through my little neighborhood. I protect them.
Soledad looks up at him, narrowing one eye, as she searches his expression for indications of deceit. She finds none.
Okay. Danilo laughs.
Okay?
Yes, okay, Soledad says. They are quiet again for a few moments.
You ever have any trouble? Lorenzo asks from behind them. Ever get beat up or anything?
Danilo turns without removing the machete from his shoulder and looks back at him.
Not anymore, he says.
Lorenzo nods and jams his hands into his pockets.
Cool, cool.
Luca begins chatting with Danilo and the sisters, so Lydia drops back to walk beside Lorenzo. She's both repelled by him and drawn to the information he might be able to provide. Maybe he knows which cartels have alliances with Los Jardineros, which routes present the greatest dangers of her being recognized. She doesn't know how to begin the conversation, because in her mind, every question sounds like an accusation. Finally, she speaks one out loud.
How is it that you came to be traveling alone? Don't you have family in Guerrero?
Nah, not really.
Lorenzo has plucked up a blade of dry grass from beside the tracks and tucked it into the corner of his mouth. He speaks past it. My mom got married a few years ago, and her husband didn't really want me around, so I split. Lydia glances over at him. How old are you?
17.
Younger than she thought.
And how old when you left home?
Lorenzo looks up from his feet and snags the grass blade from his mouth.
I don't know. 13, 14. Old enough to look after myself.
Lydia takes care not to contradict him, but he feels it anyway. Not everybody has a mommy like you, all right?
Some mothers don't give a shit.
He tosses the grass at his feet.
I'm sorry, Lydia says.
Whatever. No importa. He slings his hands into the pockets of his baggy shorts. I was traveling with my homeboy anyway. We left together because he wanted to get out too, but then we got separated in Mexico City, and I haven't heard from him since.
But you have a cell phone, she says.
Yeah, his stopped working.
Oh.
They walk quietly for a few minutes, and then he says,
Yo, it was really sad what happened to El Jefe's daughter, but for real, what he did to your family?
Eso fue de locos.
Lydia frowns.
What?
La lechuza. What he did to your family, it was too much. When I saw that girl on the news in her quinceañera dress,
that girl.
My niece.
Yeah.
My goddaughter, Jennifer.
Yeah. When I saw her on the news, I mean, for real, I was already thinking about leaving, but that was it for me.